Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
And welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
G'day, Ben. So, Ben, today on the show, we have Sons Tattoo. Sons had a short military career before transitioning out of the military and becoming a bouncer. He studied martial arts from a young age, including overseas for some years in Korea and Japan. And based on his street experience in some of the roughest and toughest establishments in Australia, he designed his own fighting system to be applied, to be practical, and to be contemporary. Now, with no money, Sons headed to Johannesburg in South Africa. And amidst months and months of rejection of him trying to sell his fighting system, he finally found one believer. Now, success begets success. He taught the system across the country and finally got an opportunity to teach President Nelson Mandela's bodyguard. Now, in this interview, he recounts his personal interactions with President Nelson Mandela, amongst a range of other things. Now, most recently, and unlike most ex-bodyguards, Sons has studied postgraduate law and taught conflict resolution across a number of continents. He's now a professional speaker. And this interview, Ben, has Sons giving us a little bit of humorous everything from Nelson Mandela across into some philosophies and principles that he drew from being a nightclub bouncer. He also gives us his practical tool that enables us to measure and improve our own resilience. Let's get on with the show. Okay. And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 with my co-host, Ben.
G'day, Tim.
And I'm Tim Curtis. And joining us today, Ben, we have Monsieur Sons Tattoo.
We do. G'day.
G'day,
how are you? Mystery guest. Welcome, Sons.
Well, I'm just very happy to be here and that Ben Robert Smith cancelled at the last minute and you couldn't get anybody else.
Well, actually, you were our number one. He was our number two.
Is that right? That makes me feel even better.
Okay. So which is more difficult? Walking into a room to try and teach teams how to be better, or standing on the door of a nightclub, fielding people, entry to the nightclub?
Interesting question. I think that probably the room full of strangers in a commercial setting, because if you're standing on the door, there's a simplicity to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not complicated. It's not rocket science. If somebody pisses you off, well, you just say you can't come in. But in a room full of strangers in a commercial setting with the purpose of being able to generate revenue, I can't tell people to laugh at my jokes. I can't tell people to get their pens out. I can't tell people to pay attention. So it's harder. You have to think more quickly. You have to be more observant. You have to see who's nodding their head, who's not. So back in the front door of the nightclub, no, there's a simplicity. Of course, there is the raw element that sometimes they might try and punch you in the head. That hasn't happened so far as a corporate presenter. But I have seriously irritated some people in my corporate audiences, for sure.
Now, you married a South African, and therefore you married the continent of Africa. You've spent a lot of time in Africa.
Mm.
What are your endearing memories? What are the things that you truly treasure about Africa and your experiences in Africa?
What I loved about Africa, when I first stepped off the plane and I had a budget, you know, that was virtually non-existent, and I'd never been to Africa. I landed in Johannesburg in South Africa, and I wanted to get to Pretoria, their political capital, because I just wanted to knock on doors, and I thought I'd go to the police headquarters there. And to save money, I hitchhiked from Johannesburg to Pretoria. And I just remember being struck by an electricity. There was an energy, a vibrancy. And it was that mix of street side entrepreneurship that, you know, can we sell you something? Can we give you a scam? Like, can we rip you off? Can we help you? You know, where are you from? All that mixed together. So I will always treasure that trip, that first trip from Johannesburg to Pretoria as I hitchhiked. Beyond that, I suppose, and without gravitating here just for the sake of the name, but the interactions that I was fortunate enough to have with Nelson Mandela, because he was everything you'd want him to be and a little bit more. And often, and you'd know this as well, you meet high-profile people and they have a particular mask that they put on in front of a crowd or in front of the media or both. And that crowd goes and the media goes and the mask goes and you think, bloody hell, what a disappointment. President Mandela wasn't like that. And I'm not saying that I had, you know, this deep, profound relationship, but I had enough interactions with him to watch him and have some conversations, and he met my wife and he met my children, he met my mother-in-law. I was just so impressed because the man was regal. That's the word that, to me, sums him up most accurately. He was regal in the sense that you knew you're in the presence of someone kingly, someone noble, not in a pretentious or flashy way, but in a way that, no, this is a person that makes a difference, and this is a person that you can walk away a little bit better than when you arrived. And I did. I really did.
Mm. I want to fill in a few blanks because you designed your own fighting system. You believed in it. You went to Africa thinking that that's what you would do. You would teach your fighting system to anyone willing to take it on. You had a lot of difficulty in selling the concept. There was no believers in the fighting system. And then using something you've told me before, you found one person who had a little bit of belief in it and gave you a go. Mm. And then fast forward to the work that you did with Nelson Mandela's personal bodyguard. So can we perhaps talk about, in a colloquial sense, that rags to riches, but maybe also the literal sense, you know, you were hitchhiking, trying to sell that system that you believed in, that fighting system, and then fast forward, you realised probably catastrophic success. How was that contrast?
The journey was, of course, anyone's journey is... has multiple elements to it. But my journey in some ways was fueled by the principle of Kaizen, that Japanese concept of continual improvement. And also my journey, looking back retrospectively, was influenced by the principle that if you really want to know something, teach it. And it's just so true, because when you have students, they ask questions that you never consider, and it challenges your assumptions. It's very unsettling. And part of why I wanted to make that system work was I did believe it had value. I did believe that it could, I don't want to sound grandiose here, but it could actually save lives of martial professionals, police officers, military people. So I wanted to teach it, but I also wanted to learn. I wanted to get better. So I chose South Africa in early 94 because of the changes that were taking place, dynamic, positive change. And I thought, well, if I can go there, given that country's history, and if I can be a part of its new history in some small way, that'll be satisfying, that'll be interesting, and how much will I learn? So when I stepped off the plane in Johannesburg and I hitchhiked to Pretoria, it was the most, in some ways, exciting period of my life because I was off. This is it. This is the adventure. And yes, there were lots of barriers along the way. There were, you know, why are you here? We're not interested. We have our own instructors. They are the best in the world. We have no money to pay you. Even if we did, we wouldn't pay you because we've never heard of you. If we had heard of you, you'd be famous, therefore you're not. So therefore, we won't pay you any money because you can't possibly have anything to pay it on. That was the conversation loop expressed over and over and over again. And then I found one exception, one person that was prepared to just have a go, have a look. And he pulled off a small miracle. He got funding for a trial course. The feedback was good, run another course and another course. Within 6 months, I'd run courses for instructors from the South African Army, Navy, Prison Service, Drug Unit, Anti-Terrorist Team, and among others, Nelson Mandela's bodyguard team.
It's really funny. We spoke with Phil Hayes St. Clair a number of weeks ago, and what you've just described, because you're very old, they hadn't invented the word of entrepreneur.
I'm not sure that was said as a compliment.
You were just telling us to get some time up. It works both ways.
Because he's so incredibly experienced.
Because of your experience, your trailblazing experience, they hadn't developed the term entrepreneur to describe what you've done, the journey you've taken. But of course, that's exactly what it is. It is, in many ways, almost the identical path that we were speaking about that Phil Hayes St. Clair deals with in the tech space. You know, having this idea, having that belief in the idea, Kaizen, failing fast, learning, continual improvement, and being able to keep progressing through. What would it have taken for you to give up? This is something I keep asking guests because I'm really interested in. I love that never say die attitude, but what if you're flogging a dead horse? How do you know that your idea, how would you, Sons, have known that technique was a lemon? What would it have taken for that to...
Well, there's a phrase I like, sometimes the best plan B is to make plan A work. I also like the history behind WD-40, which you may be familiar
Order
with.
Order displacement, yeah. 39.
Yeah, 40. So they had 39 formulas that failed before they got it right. So I believe in persistence. That said, yeah, there's a line in the sand for everything. And I think it probably would have been economic because but when I arrived in South Africa... prior to that, you know, I, for among other things, spent 3 years living in Korea, Japan, and China, studying martial arts full time, teaching English part time, living on rice and pickled cabbage, sleeping on a floor, and I'd funded that in part by a very small compensation payment that I received when I was medically discharged from the army. I didn't have much money, and by the time I came back from Asia, I was in debt. By the time I got to the point where I arrived in South Africa, I had a handful of dollars. You know? So it was hard. It was incredibly hard financially. And I did that 2 months before I found someone that said yes. And by the time that I had that one person that was prepared to take a risk, I was literally living on rice, not rice, I was literally living on oranges and biltong. And I had been for days. And he was up in an area, it's not called Petersburg anymore, but the far northern Transvaal. And he said, look, we come up and we can have a chat face to face. I was in Johannesburg and I didn't have any money. I managed to phone up a friend in Australia and got enough money to buy a bus ticket from Johannesburg to Petersburg. And we had a chat, and thankfully he was a very dynamic individual and he got funding straight away. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have the money to get back to Johannesburg because this is at the end of my tether and perhaps the stars were aligning, who knows. And then he said, okay, well, I've got funding. Let's start a course on Monday. You can stay at my place. And I stayed with him for 2 weeks. He just he didn't know me from a bar of soap. Yeah. Stayed with him and his wife, and he ended up becoming best man at my wedding.
That's very cool. The second question that I want to ask about this particular part of your life, you talk about Kaizen and continual improvement, but that I think is reliant on an awareness that you haven't got the perfect solution. So on one hand, you've got a firm belief that this technique is of value and can really help the world. How do you stay open to areas of improvement? How do you sort of get over, I guess, being so in love with your idea that you're open to, you know, the dumb question from the student that that makes a good modification to your program?
When I arrived in South Africa, I believed that I had a good solid program. And that wasn't because I'd won a few competitions or trophies or anything like that. It's because I'd worked in pubs and nightclubs and I'd been in Papua New Guinea for 18 months as well. And I'd been in enough confrontations to know that, yeah, I'm not completely hopeless here. And that was a mistake, but I reckon if I do that next time, it'll get a better outcome. And it did. So I had enough practical experience to justifiably believe it was good. That said, when I arrived in South Africa, it was just a good program. It wasn't a great program because it was limited by my experiences and my understanding. But what happened by working with all of those different individuals, and then word of mouth kicked in, and I started to do work with some very high profile organisations, including 22 SAS at Hereford and the FBI in the States, because the calibre of the participants was so high, it was inevitable that one of two things was going to happen. My ego would snap, or I'd go, what a great opportunity to learn. And I'm grateful that I recognised it as an opportunity to learn. Mind you, I still stubbornly held on to some elements for far too long because I was emotionally wedded to them, because for ridiculous reasons, I'd been doing it for such a long time. Or I'd learnt it from someone who I liked and admired, but they probably didn't have a lot of practical experience. On the other side, there were things that I had learnt in the past and discarded because I didn't like the people that had taught them to me. That's not a good reason to discard something. Yeah. So there were lots of full circle moments in that particular journey.
So before we leave the continent of Africa, we couldn't leave Africa without having a Nelson Mandela story. Could you share an anecdote or two?
Sure. Well, one of my favourite stories with the president, and I think it says so much about his personality, but he was in the Union Building. It's their Parliament House, and he was having a heated debate with an old adversary on the other side of the house. And a lot of people have formed the opinion that Nelson Mandela was this Gandhi-like figure without the bedsheet, always smiling and polite and friendly. That guy had steel in him. Yeah, he had an anger that he focused, and rightly so. Anyway, he's in their Parliament House and he stands up and he's having this really heated debate with someone from the other side of the house, different political party, and he points at him and he says, you are a Mickey Mouse leader of a Mickey Mouse party and your politics belong with Mickey Mouse. The president's angry. That's the way he expresses himself. Anyway, about a week later, the victim of Mandela's tirade suffered a massive heart attack. Triple bypass surgery undoubtedly saved his life. He's lying in hospital recovering, curtain partition around his bed, middle of the day, normal hospital noises, you know, trolleys clunking, buzzers going off. And then there's this strange silence. You hear a little bit of traffic, creaking, not much. Then you hear these footsteps coming down the hallway, sort of. Then doctors start to talk in hushed tones, nurses were whispering. Then in this very loud, very distinct voice, you heard these words. Mickey! Hello, Mickey! I've come to visit you. It's me, Goofy.
That's superb. And he himself was a boxer and a stick fighter.
He was indeed, yes, and a very disciplined person. And that's one of the things, one of the many things that I admire about him. But it's one of the many things I admire about many people. I think that discipline is such a consistent foundation. But the fact that he did have an interest in martial pursuits, Western boxing, African stick fighting, I think was an advantage, because I'll give you another story if you want one. But the first time that I had anything to do with the president, I'd been in country for a while and I'd been running courses for a lot of different organisations, including his bodyguard team, but I hadn't had a chance to actually cross paths with the president. And I was pretty keen to do so. It just hadn't happened. Anyway, this particular day, we're out on the grassed garden area and I had one of his teams out there, and it happened to be a physical session. There were some non-physical modules to the program as well, but this happened to be a physical one. We're out there in the grassed area sort of doing our stuff, and I look over and the presidential limousine is just driving very slowly just past my class, and then it stops and I look and the back window's down, and in the back seat is President Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, and he's watching my class. Knowing that he did have an interest in martial pursuits. I really turned up the juice then. I'm zigging and zagging and my voice gets a bit deeper. And I look over again and there's this hand in the, beckoning me over. So I said to my class, and this is what any self-respecting trainer would say, just wait a moment, please. The president wants to talk to me. And then swag it across, ever so important. Well, you're probably in high school, Ben. And
this was 1994
or something like that. Swag it across to the limousine. And when I was about 10 feet away, he pointed at me, directly at me, sans tattoo. And he points and he says, yo, Aussie, be careful of my flower beds. And drove off.
First and most memorable encounter. Yes. Not most memorable, because you were invited to have lunch with the president. And I think you took your family.
A couple of times. The first time with my wife after we were married, he heard that I'd married a South African. And very generously, he invited my wife and I along to have lunch with him. A really good example of a leader who's interested in people and helping people, even if it's not helpful to him. He had better things to do than spend time with an ex-bouncer from Australia.
And possibly, you know, there was no ulterior motive. He didn't think he was going to get anything out of it. He just did it.
We had a lovely lunch with him. And that was the first time he met my wife. And he comes in, or we were introduced, and he comes in and he looks at her and he looks at me and back at my wife and he says, Madam, you are a very beautiful woman. Tell me, why are you with him?
Fantastic. And you've actually got some beautiful photographs with the president. And I think you've previously said those photographs mean nothing to him, but mean everything to you.
Yes.
And small gesture.
Small gesture, yeah. He, when we, at the end of his presidency, by that stage, I'd married a South African and we'd had one child together. We were expecting our second. And he came down to my last ever training session. And my wife was there. Our child was there. My mother-in-law was there. And we had a really nice group photo together. And he noticed that my wife was pregnant again. And he says, Ozzy, I see your wife is pregnant again. I said, yes, sir, she is. He said, good, very good. But you must remember, Ozzy, there is only one thing a child owes a parent. Yeah, I'm calculating the dollars. I think it must be a fair bit already, and they're not even big yet. And then he says, nothing. A child does not owe a parent gratitude. A child does not owe a parent respect. Those things are gifts the child chooses to give, but only if the parent deserves them. Mm. You think about that, and that really challenges how you approach parenthood. And not just parenthood, but the people you interact with, you know, your clients, your colleagues, your neighbors, they owe you nothing except the respect and the gratitude that you deserve.
That you deserve. It's a wonderful philosophy. We, in fact, speaking of philosophies, we've spoken a number of times about Stoicism, and that's a philosophy that's often associated with Nelson Mandela. Certainly he, I think, has said that Invictus, the poem, was one of his favourites and was something he used to help him get through his incarceration. Do you sort of follow the Stoic philosophy? Do you believe, have you seen an applicability in your life?
Yeah, I'm attracted to the Stoic philosophy, but I don't know if that's a contrarian element of my personality that may not be attractive, but I'm quite, I was going to say repulsed, but that's too strong a term, but I'm definitely not engaged by the materialism and the bling of what is so overwhelming in our society now. And because of that, I find myself more and more attracted to the Stoics.
I think too, and maybe I'm looking for it, but it seems we are so eager to be offended these days. We're looking for something that can make us upset or that can make us enraged or, you know, that we can take offence to. And I think a little dose of stoicism would be a healthy thing across society, that, you know, let's not get too worked up by what other people are doing, and let's concentrate more about leading the best life we can live. And, you know, the Stoics were never had any aversion to material stuff, but I think your point about the bling, the materialism for its own sake, or as a metric to show off or to compare yourself against others, it is pretty insidious.
You're right. We do live in an age of outrage, and there's something wrong. There's something out of whack. My mum was born in Melbourne in 1935. And back then, the government of the day decided that her mum, my grandmother, was unfit to be a parent. So they forcibly removed my mother from her family and put her into an institution. She was there for 3 years before she was adopted. My mum had no memory of that period of her life. It wasn't until she was 50 that she learnt the truth about her history, and it rocked her. She never really recovered. And that history included the fact that she had two sisters. Tragically, one of them died before my mum learnt that she was adopted, and my mum died before she was able to speak with the remaining sister. And the reason I'm saying that is that recently we had a friend, well, more my wife's friend than my friend, I like her, but their five-week-old puppy died, and the young son found it. Well, they've gone into emotional and social meltdown over that. Their Facebook, their Twitter, everything that they're connected to socially has reflected that enormous suffering and pain. And they are predicting, I think, I may be wrong, but I think they're actually propagating problems in the future because of this, what I think is a disproportional response. My mum had reasons to be upset. But it's almost like some people don't have reasons to be upset, so they find something or engineer something that is so irrelevant, it becomes terribly unhealthy. And there's something not right about that.
And I think part of it is it's a well-meaning thing. We want to look after people who have suffered, but we almost create a narrative where if anything's happened to you, you must be suffering. Your life must be unraveling. And we've spoken before about post-traumatic growth, where some people are able to, you know, deal with incredible trauma, but use that in as positive a way as possible. You know, be able to use that as a platform to acknowledge their own resilience in getting through it in the first place, and, you know, as a springboard to challenging new or to facing new challenges into the future. Whereas I worry that the society of outrage that we were just speaking about almost primes us to, you know, the slightest thing just makes us crumple into the fetal position sobbing. Let's move on from physical conflict to corporate conflict. You are currently a corporate entertainer.
I am.
And I'd be really interested in, as a bridge, we spoke about some of the techniques for dealing with that sort of nerves or the apprehension, the physiological manifestations of, you know, an impending physical conflict. Do you use similar sort of techniques when you're about to face a potentially hostile room and, you know, you're getting those same first of all, do you get the same physiological reactions? And second of all, how do you deal with it? How do you get through?
There have been times when I've definitely had those physiological changes, and the surefire first step for dealing with that is to control your breathing.
Yeah.
It works. You guys know that. It's why surgeons get taught it. That's why ballerinas get taught it. That's why snipers get taught it. It works to control your breathing. I've also been on the spectrum where I've got complacent with corporate audiences, and as a result, my heart rate hasn't been accelerated enough. I've been a bit bored in advance. That doesn't end well because as the presenter, you are the generator. You are the focal point. You have a responsibility to engage with that group of people and to provide them with something that keeps them engaged. So in my case, I'm just an entertainer. I do Nelson Mandela impersonations and I tell funny stories and I used to be a bouncer. But I still have a responsibility to engage. And in the journey, my particular journey of going from being an unarmed combat instructor to a corporate presenter, I've definitely stumbled along the way. I've made mistakes, including the fact that I haven't been focused enough. So it's that sweet spot that you need to find. And I do that, it might sound a bit odd, but one of the ways that I do that is I have a type of ritual. And every time before I speak, I recite out loud The Man from Snowy River. And it's my warm-up, like a boxer on the bags or a boxer on the mitt. Bang, 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 bang. I'm getting into gear. And for me, I find that helpful.
We did it with Andrew Hastie. We're going to do it with Sans Tattoo. Man from Snowy River by Sans Tattoo.
There was movement at the station, for the word had passed around that the colt from Old Regret had got away and had joined the wild bush horses. He was worth £1,000, so all the cracks had gathered to the fray. All the tried and noted riders from the stations near and far had mustered at the homestead overnight, for the bushmen love hard riding where the wild bush horses are, and the stock horse snuffs the battle with delight. There was Harrison, who made his pile when Pardon won the cup, the old man with his hair as white as snow. But few could ride beside him when his blood was fairly up. He would go wherever horse and man could go. And Clancy, of the Overflow, came down to lend a hand. No better horseman ever held the reins. For never horse could throw him while the saddle girths would stand. He learnt to ride while droving on the plains. And one was there, a stripling, on a small and weedy beast. He was something like a racehorse, undersized, with a touch of Timor pony, three parts thoroughbred at least, and such as are by mountain horsemen prized. He was hard and tough and wiry, just the sort that won't say die. There was courage in his quick, impatient tread, and he bore the badge of gameness in his bright and fiery eye and the proud and lofty carriage of his head. But still, so slight and weedy, one would doubt his power to stay, and the old man said, "That horse will never do. For a long and tiring gallop, lad, you'd better stop away. Those hills are far too rough for such as you." I mean, I think that's enough.
That's fantastic. And Ben and I will attest there was not one note, not one endeavour to reference to one note, just the wistful look into the distance as you recited that
poem. I got
halfway
through and I thought, fellas, do you know this goes for about 8.5 minutes?
Yeah. I'm thinking, well, I was lost in them. I really enjoyed that. But I was thinking maybe we do edit it.
But it actually really highlights a point I wanted to ask you about, the importance of narrative. I mean, the storytelling, the ability to convey with passion in a lyrical sort of format, you know, it carries a lot of meaning. You know, humans are narrative creatures.
We
learn
indeed
through story. Do you deliberately incorporate stories in your speaking style to convey a point in a more powerful fashion?
Yes, I do. Storytelling is the foundation and the core of what I do as a presenter, as an educator. And it's timeless. We have been sharing knowledge via stories for longer than we have been sharing anything. Around the campfire, how do you hunt? How does a child be born? Like, it's storytelling that really is the human experience. That we all have our story. You know, and we are engaged by a good story. We listen to a good storyteller. And I'm not saying I'm a good storyteller. I'm just saying it is my vehicle. But I love the art of storytelling. Yeah. And what I love about Banjo Patterson is that he's a storyteller. That man from Snowy River, that's a classic story. You know, you've got the downtrodden character. You've got the people against him, the old man, that horse will never do. And you've got Clancy who sticks by him. And then he gets an opportunity. He gets his chance to say, "Here I am. Take a look at me. I'm not backing down." And through courage and skill and experience and pure heart, he goes forward. That's great stuff.
And I think there's something in that for leaders across the board. You know, there is a chasm of difference between getting a point across, telling some facts, and telling it in a memorable way that resonates at a human level. And I mean, as you said, sounds, we've known this forever. Aesop's fables, I mean, you'd say, don't be jealous of other things, or you can tell this amazing story about a fox and a set of grapes. Yeah. You know, it carries so much more potency, and it's something that I think we probably should be using a bit more in our day-to-day lives.
I agree completely. Yeah. And there is a movement within the corporate sector that acknowledges that, and you get professional storytelling coaches now.
It's interesting, you know, Lucy, age 13, hijacked our podcast before, but there's some truth that comes from the mouth of babes, and we love to tell stories to our kids. I mean, the onomatopoeia of a Dr. Zeus.
Yes.
Or the message that's buried inside a Mr. Brave or a Miss Messy, you know, that these kids just perched up on your knee. Read it again, Dad. Read it again, Dad. I actually think we're not much different as adults. We love to hear a great story. And I wanted to ask a question.
Don't invite your subordinates at work to get on your knee to hear a story. That's
not a... We're not endorsing that.
Communications. We've reflected, Ben, before on the importance of communications. Good communications are a bearer for good leadership. No point being the most fantastic leader if you can't both listen and talk. What are the secrets to communicating a message? What do you know that in your workshops really resonates, that assists in the comprehension of the things that you're ultimately trying to say?
Well, as you communicated that question, the word that jumped out most loudly at me was secret. And like everyone, we have biases and defaults, and that always triggers a very specific response in my mind. And it's a quote by the great martial arts master Masayama, and his answer to the question, what is the secret of martial arts? He said, sweat. There is no other secret. And I believe that applies to any worthwhile endeavor, including communication. So what does sweat look like in the context of communication? You have to read, I think. Good communicators, good leaders are readers. You have to be able to write well, because writing refines your ability to express yourself. You have to stop and consider word usage and structure. So you have to invest in reading. You have to invest in writing. You have to invest in education itself. But you also have to stand in front of groups of people and talk. There's no substitute for that. And if you don't like public speaking, you have to get over yourself if you want to be an effective leader. And you have to acknowledge that it's like any skill. You'll get someone who's just naturally talented and naturally good. And you may never be as good as them, but you can be better than what you are now. And the best way to be a better public speaker, a live communicator, is to speak in public. And if that means you have to find reasons, if you have to engineer reasons to stand in front of a group of people and speak, well, you find those reasons. Yep. If it's just the toolbox start meeting, if it's your chance to open the boardroom meeting, or welcome, this is what we're going through, handing over to the CEO. But if you only got 30 seconds, you still got 30 seconds. And each time you do that, that's your sweat. Each time you find an excuse not to do it, that's your complacency. And you cannot get better with complacency. You can only get better with sweat.
You've made a career also reading body language. What are the secrets of the use of body language in that stage presence or the theatre of communicating?
You know the answer to any secret question is going to be sweat, Tim.
Maybe what are some tips?
Mystery.
Tim's got his thesaurus out.
It begins by having a consciousness. You have to develop a consciousness associated with body language, yours and other people's. If you don't have a consciousness, that is, you're not looking for it, you're not aware of it, you don't recognize and acknowledge that it matters, everything will go over the top of your head. I'm like a lot of people in my profession, I'm a people watcher.
I spend a lot of time at airports like you guys do. If I'm bored with reading whatever I'm reading, I'll just watch the crowds. And that's part of the consciousness. It's an ongoing skill. I don't think I'm particularly good at reading the subtleties of body language, but I'm good enough to stand in front of a room full of strangers as a presenter and say, well, that person's not with me. And either's that one. So I'll then, to extend on your question about the stagecraft, I don't speak from behind a podium. So I will walk in among the audience and I'll put my hand on that person's shoulder and I'll say, how are you? Because I'm just sans tattoo, the ex-bouncer who's an entertainer. So there are less boundaries for me. But it is a vital part of communication. But it begins with consciousness.
Mm. And again, Sans, if you were a little younger, you'd probably refer to that. You'd probably refer to that as emotional intelligence. A couple of things you've spoken about, you know, being aware of other people, their body language, and even that idea of putting yourself in the other person's shoes, you know, whether you're running next to them or whether, you know, you're assessing they're being scared as a bouncer. That is essentially what we now call this fancy new term, emotional intelligence, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if you're a little older, you wouldn't be taken in by labels such as emotional intelligence.
Touché. What about entertainment versus education? We've spoken about this in roundabout terms during this conversation, and I want to take it more into this sort of leadership space. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about communication, mm-hmm. how it's an essential, learnable, mm-hmm. practicable, fundamental skill for leadership. What about the idea of entertainment as a leadership tactic?
I think just as storytelling is an effective, therefore a valuable medium to influence thought and an extension of that is behavior, then entertainment is an effective medium of engaging a listener. I think, like anything, there's a tipping point. How much is enough? How much is too much? Mm. It's a bit like, you know, you buy a muesli bar and it's got chocolate coating and it's got sugar and it's got other elements that aren't health related, but it's called a muesli bar. At what point, at what percentage does it stop being a muesli bar and it's just straight confectionery?
As I asked that question, I flashed to the Office, either the British or the American series, and I think both David Brent and Michael Scott described, I'm probably an entertainer first and a boss second. You know, like that got, so probably not a good, let's not go full on down that path in a corporate sense, but there's something in there, isn't there?
Oh, there definitely is, yeah. And I think it's a mistake to dismiss it. For some people dismiss it almost on moral or ethical grounds. Oh, well, I'm a leader. I'm not an entertainer. Mm. Well, you probably will be a better leader if you can have an element of entertainment. Mm. And then you have to work out what is an effective form of entertainment for you as the individual. Is it standing there and telling jokes and gags? Well, that's hard to do for anybody. I don't tell jokes and gags. Mm. I tell true stories that some people find humorous or entertaining. But you have to find your own way. But it's definitely worth acknowledging that it has value. And I think more as we progress in time and you, say, get a bit more wisdom and you get as old as I am, you'll find that the generations of today want more entertainment in the future. And the ones that can't entertain in an appropriate way and with an appropriate percentage, I think they're really going to struggle.
And we, before we started rolling this interview, were talking about the dilemmas facing tertiary education institutions at the moment. And I've had reflected to me that in many ways, lecturing these days is like being on a reality show, that you live and die by your student rankings. Mm. And if you're not entertaining, then you're like a gladiator in the Colosseum. You get the thumbs down and you get axed. Of course, it's not that simple. Mm. But when we've got this world where you can access, you know, the highest sort of caliber of information on the internet, then you need something more than that if you're to engage at a human level. And maybe part of that is entertainment. Now, whether that's just that narrative aspect or the emotional engagement, you know, it's I think something interesting that we need to reflect on.
I think that the pendulum has swung in the other direction towards entertainment, rightly so, because just because someone is a highly qualified academic, if they're as boring as batshit, that's a wasted opportunity and it's insulting to the members of their audience or their class. So it's almost a pompousness in saying, well, I don't need to be entertaining.
You're not operating on my level.
Let's talk about the evolution of the human species into a goldfish.
That's a nice segue.
I'm specifically talking about our decreasing attention span. Some interesting studies out that the average human attention span now is 7 seconds. So politicians are delivering things in seven-second sound bites. When you jump on your Instagram, the video goes for around about that same sort of time. How are you seeing it being a professional presenter? Are our attention spans really getting that bad?
You lost me because you waffled for about 12 seconds.
That's excellent. It's not a 30-second question about our 7-second attention spans.
Could you give me a condensed version, just an expound second process?
Why do we only have a 7-second attention span?
That one I can get my teeth into.
That only took 4 seconds.
Well done. I think it's the result of a lot of different factors. And if I go back to the world of professional speaking, the TED Talk has changed professional speaking significantly, because typically when I first started, a keynote presentation was 60 minutes. That was stock standard. You fill the 60 minutes. Since the TED Talk has gained traction and awareness, more and more event planners, clients, and conference organizers think a keynote should be 20 minutes. And having so many people who have watched TED Talks, they've actually become conditioned, pre-programmed to think that a talk goes for 20 minutes. And I think that is one example of how we as a society are being conditioned. I think it's represented in other elements of society, and you brought this up yesterday, Tim, that with that 7-second time frame, politicians are trying to get all of their messages into 7 seconds or less. What happens is then the consumer of that message is getting conditioned to hearing things in 7 seconds or less. I'll go off on a bit of a tangent, but I think it answers your question.
Please stay under the 7 seconds.
I think it's in Norway, but what they've done is they've started to put traffic light walking signals at pedestrian crossings electronically on the ground at the footpath, because they realize that people are using their mobile devices and they look down and they can see the signal on the by their feet, but they don't look up. So that's clever and interesting. They're addressing a problem, but on another level, they're actually reinforcing the problem. And I think that's what happens with communication, because attention spans are becoming more and more condensed or contracted. People are then providing or attempting to provide their message in a more and more contracted time frame, and the consumer is getting more and more conditioned. And it becomes this process that builds on itself and makes it worse.
And the other really insidious part of that is we're trying to get very complex, and I use that term deliberately, complex issues into a 7-second soundbite, which only lends itself to a black or white reductionist view.
Yep.
So, you know, you talk about immigration, we'll pick your contentious topic, but there's no way you can summarise these various shades of grey and perspectives and different views on something as complex as that in a soundbite. And it kind of polarizes people's thinking.
Yes.
And we see all sorts of manifestations in the political landscape of that, which I don't think is healthy.
So this leads us on to the goldfish series of questions. Quick answer, quick question.
In fact, is that the format? Did I miss a scripting or something? Is that how you finish all your
goldfish
podcasts?
Series? Actually, I'm going to start with some questions that the Stoics like, the deep but shapeless questions. What do you love?
My family.
And what do you live by?
A simple appreciation that nothing lasts forever.
What do you think the purpose of life is?
To experience and to make a contribution.
What's your definition of happiness?
To be grateful and content with what you have.
And your definition of success?
To be appreciated by people who I appreciate.
You're very old, so you're very close to death. But when you are close to death, which won't be too far away, what would your advice be to people who are less close to death than you are?
I will give you a quote from Leonardo da Vinci. As a well-spent day brings satisfied sleep, so too does a well-spent life bring satisfied death. My advice on that deathbed would be a participant, not a spectator.
And if you had one thing you could change in this crazy world of 7-second sound bites, what would that be?
I'd encourage people to lighten up.
And Jahari's window, what are the things that people don't know about you?
I'm very good looking. My humility is extraordinary. What don't they know about me? Well, I'm quite content that there are lots of things they don't know about me.
Good answer.
It sounds like it's going to stay that way.
Let's transition out of the goldfish series of questions because we've gone longer than 7 seconds on that series of questions.
I lost interest. But carry on.
Ben pushed his chair back about 15 minutes ago. Let's talk about resilience.
Mm.
And you have a model for resilience that you talk to. We were in a workshop this morning. I watched that really resonate with the people in the workshop.
Mm.
For all those people that are listening... How many is it, Ben?
People listening, including us. There's mum.
Pull out a pen and paper and draw a window on it. And maybe, Rob, you can talk to that window on the sort of things that you think do build resilient individuals and collectively a resilient organisation.
From what I've seen, and I've been very fortunate to work with some great people, and after a while...
Yeah, we are.
Such as Ben Pronk. I can't think of anybody else that springs to mind, but I have worked with some very impressive individuals on a number of levels. And from what I've seen, it's their capacity to pass the test of time that really separates them. You get flashes in the pan in all sorts of industries, but the ones that keep going, I think they are the most noteworthy and the most admirable. And from what I've seen, their resilience isn't necessarily a gift. It's not some cosmic lotto. I've observed that there are patterns, there are behaviours, and it comes down to, rather than viewing resilience as a throwaway line, as something you tell someone to be, like, Tim, toughen up, buttercup. Well, yeah. They're just words. It doesn't matter how you express it, but it's still just words. But if you look at resilience as a dividend that comes from making very specific investments, then there's something pragmatic about that. There's something tangible. You can get your hands on it. And my model is very simple, and it just consists of four quadrants, and it acknowledges, well, it works on the premise that resilience is a dividend, and if you make investments in those four specific quadrants, then you will be putting something into the bank. And when the pressure's on, you'll be able to have something to withdraw, because stress is not the problem. The problem is a lack of recovery. That's the problem. So when you invest in recovery, then you become more resilient. But it's not instantaneous. You have to invest now, And then tomorrow you've got a little bit there. You invest this week and this month and this year, then next week, next month, next year, you've got more. So if you think of that, those four quadrants, the top left-hand quadrant is simply mind. So you need to do something that's separate to what's ever generating the stress. So the key here is it's separate to. You're not switching off, you're switching to. So switching to reading or switching to listening to music, or in your case, Ben, switching to your art. It's something that's separate to. The top right-hand quadrant is body. Number one killer in Australia is heart disease. It's not my opinion. It's from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. The number one contributor to heart disease is a lack of exercise and poor diet. Not my opinion. It's from the Australian Medical Association. What we put into our body and what we do with our body matters. And when you use that quadrant as part of your recovery, then you are investing in your future capacity to function effectively in a pressure situation. What does that look like? The details are secondary. Are you going to the gym? Are you swimming? Are you playing badminton? Are you walking? Are you working in the garden, playing a hack game of golf? All secondary. What's important is that it is recovery. It's separate to whatever's generating the stress. The bottom left-hand quadrant is social. We are a social creature. One of the worst things you can do to a prisoner of war is to separate them from their colleagues. One of the cruelest forms of punishment for a prisoner in any setting is solitary confinement. We need interaction, and that interaction fuels us. It's part of our recovery. What does that look like in practical terms? Again, the details are secondary. Is it having coffee with your friend? Is it going to the footy with your mates? Is it going to the theatre? Is it being involved in some type of Rotary Club or Lions Club or going to the church, the synagogue, the mosque? It's something that's separate to whatever's generating, and it's a social interaction. And the fourth one, and in some ways, I'm inclined to think this is the most important of the four. That said, the other three matter as well. But the fourth one is global. You need a global perspective, something bigger than yourself. So it's a charity. It's coaching a kid's sporting team. It's reading at the old elderly home to people that can't read anymore. It's something bigger than you. And the key from what I've seen from working with a lot of different people from a lot of different industries and a lot of different cultures is they spread the load. Some people look at that model and they go, oh, I've got that nailed. I swim, I cycle, I run and I go to the gym. That's great, but it's only one quadrant. And if you overinvest in one area, it's like a financial portfolio. If you've got all of your stocks in BHP, well, that's great as long as BHP is healthy and well. But if there's some disruption in that industry or something happens, you've got nowhere else to go. You need to spread the load. So the wise ones spread the load. And it's that some people will look at one of those quadrants and say, I'm not doing that. For whatever reason, they don't want to exercise or they don't want to read or whatever it may be. But three's okay. It's a bit like a dog with three legs. A dog with three legs can be surprisingly agile. Dog with less than three legs is not going anywhere.
So mind, body, social and global are the four quadrants.
They are.
And what are the little things that we could do today that would make an improvement to get balance across those four quadrants to perhaps increase our resiliency-ness?
Well, do you say we? Is that a collective we, the three here, or the other four people that listen to the podcast? Or
asking for me and my four listener friends.
I think the key to the four quadrants is identifying something that you're not doing enough of. Often people will fixate on what they're already doing as an excuse to say, well, I am resilient. And also the other one that limits them from doing something today is they're too busy. Or that's their vanity, just using a euphemism to say I'm too important to have recovery. I'm too important. I don't need to do that for whatever reason. But what does it look like? Anything, as long as it's more of something you're not doing. So it's as simple as listening to a podcast for 10 minutes, because you can't do the full one and you say, oh, well, I can't listen to the full podcast, I won't listen to any. Well, listen to 10 minutes today.
full disclosure, listening to this podcast will not help in that mind quadrant.
Not help in mind, body, social, or global. No,
this is the junk food of very lightweight. So,
I felt special to be on your show until you said that. Thanks.
But those small steps, the just making, and you right at the start, you said that common thread of successful people is that discipline, just being able to carve that habit. And I think, you know, when you were talking about this idea, I jotted down this Aristotle quote about, you know, excellence is not an act but a habit. You know, it is just that repetition, you know, the investment that can pay that dividend down the path.
How do people find out more about Sol's tattoo?
They go to www.sanstattoo.com.au.
Are you really Sol's tattoo? I think we're both avec tattoo.
I am factually Sol's tattoo.
Most excellent. Sol's tattoo, thanks very much for being on the Unforgiving 60
podcast.
Pleasure,
fellas.
Much appreciated.
Stay well, grow wise, have more birthdays and you might get there.
I got my eye on you, 'cause you won't tell me what you're doing. You bite the hand that feeds until it bites back or until it bleeds it. Ooh baby, can't you understand or can't you see the pain that you put in me? I
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers. All you businessmen, politicians, get around and meet my friend.